Welcome back to Babbittville Radio. We're brought to you every Sunday night by thecal1020.com. 10 miles, 20 bands coming up on February 15th, 2015. From Del Mar to Encinitas and back, Core Sports, the very best in women's active wear. Challenge Athletes Foundation, our 21st annual San Diego Triathlon Challenge coming up on Sunday, October 19th. And of course, you can check out any of our interviews on iTunes on Babbittville Radio. Our next guest, the greatest American miler in history, 136 sub-4-minute miles, three-time Olympian, 3:47.69 for the mile. That record only stood for about, 25 years. Mr. Steve Scott joins us. Steve, how the heck are you?
I'm doing great, Bob. How are you doing?
You know, it has been way too long, my birthday buddy.
Yes, our common birth dates. That's right.
So, funny thing, I was just interviewing Alan Webb the other day, and he's moved into triathlon. I said, you know, Alan, you might think you're the first major miler to move into triathlon, but I have photos of Steve Scott at Solana Beach Triathlon with a nose plugs and board shorts on doing a triathlon. So you are not the first.
It wasn't board shorts. I had on a bikini bathing suit.
You went Speedo.
I went Speedo, yes. I wanted every advantage I could in the water, but it didn't help me whatsoever.
So that was a short-lived career change.
All it took was a swim. I mean, one time, of course, you know, I'm a runner, so I race into the water. The gun goes off. You know, there's, I don't know how many people on the front line, and the gun goes off. I'm the first one in the water, and I'm swimming out to the buoy, and the whole field swims over the top of me. Then the second wave catches me, and they swim over the top of me. And by the time I make it into shore, I had to have swallowed like 20 ounces of ocean water, which doesn't feel very good when you get off the bike and start running. It was just sloshing around my stomach, and you know you have that nausea that you get when you drink ocean water. I felt horrible, and I go, okay, that's the end of my triathlon career.
That was plenty of that. Nice. So, Steve, growing up in Upland, California, your mom was a runner, right?
She got actually started to try to shame me into training because in eighth grade, we got recruited to go out to the high school cross-country team, and the coach had told us, well, you need to get a bunch of mileage in the summer.
Yeah.
And I'm like, nah.
That sounds like work.
Yeah. I mean, really? Run? It's hot. It's smoggy. So I would just sleep in every morning, and while my mom had been, you know, talking to the coach, and he's been saying, well, you need to get him out. You need to get him out running. So she just started. She decided to start running on her own to try to shame me into going down to running. And, of course, it didn't work. She would come in all hot and sweaty, and I go, ew, get away.
And this is not many people were running back then in terms of the whole jogging thing really hadn't taken off yet, had it?
Well, especially women. I mean, you're talking about 1970.
Yeah.
So there, you know, there were people running, but you certainly didn't see any women running. And we had the street, Euclid Avenue in Upland, and she would go out and run up Euclid up to 24th Street and back. And she would get some, you know, nasty, you know,
people yelling
from people, yeah, from, yeah, cars, and she'd get a lot of looks. But, you know, if you know my mom, you know that that didn't bother her in the slightest. And she started really feeling, you know, really good about herself, and later on she ran some races. And but like I said, her whole intention was thinking, well, if she ran and she's getting in better shape than me, then I'll want to go out and run. And like I said, didn't work.
It didn't work. But you watch the 72 Olympics on TV. You see Dave Waddle win the Golden 800. And next thing you know, you're wearing, just like Waddle with his hat on, you're wearing a hat during cross-country season. The high school years as a runner, were you one of the top guys? It seems like you were more of a late bloomer.
I was a very late bloomer, and partially because I ran cross country in the fall but played baseball in the spring both my freshman and sophomore years. So I was definitely a part-time runner. And then after my sophomore year, I decided to give track a try because, you know, as a sophomore in baseball, if you're not on varsity, then you're a loser.
Right.
So I was on the sophomore team. So you have freshman team. Then we had freshman, then the sophomore, which was an insult,
right?
And then JV and varsity. And so I was on the sophomore team, and so I felt insulted. So I decided, okay, junior year, I'm going to try out for base or try out for track. If it doesn't work out, I could always go back to baseball my senior year. And I made it to CIF prelims. Didn't make it out of the prelims. I was on a really good cross country team. So junior year, I think we won CIF, and so you know, it looked good because I was on a very good team, but I was probably like a number fifth, sixth, seventh runner, somewhere around there.
Right.
And then, like I said, in track, did make it to CIF prelims, but got knocked out. And, you know, I was running the 800 and the mile relay. So it really didn't come into together until my senior year. And that's only because now I had consistent seasons. I had a cross country, I had a track, then another cross country, then another track. So it was like 2 years of training. And, you know, senior year, it really started to come together.
Yeah, well, 158 for the 800, then you ran a 430 mile. So when did you start thinking, you know what, maybe I can run collegiately?
It was late into my senior year.
Wow.
The coach at UC Irvine, well, I was starting to get calls and letters from schools. UCLA had called, Long Beach State, BYU.
Wow.
But the one that meant the most to me was Irvine, because the coach, you know, visited me at my house. He was in, you know, pretty much constant communication with me. It was a Division II school, so it was a little less intimidating. But really, I felt like he cared more about me than any other coaches. The other coaches just seemed like, oh, here's another person that can help us get points. Where Len Miller, he really cared about my development. And, you know, he was developing a program. So that, when school started calling me, that's when I kind of figured it out. And it was, again, very late in my senior year. I started out the season, like you said, at 158. But by the end of the season, I was running 152, and I got second in the state meet.
Wow. That's a major improvement very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a lot of improvement really quickly. But so that was...
And
that kind of let me know that, okay, I could maybe do this in college.
Well, yeah, you think? so your first sub four, and I think it's Sunkissed Indoors in the junior year of college.
Yep.
When you ran that first sub four, did you surprise yourself?
You know, I ran the Olympic trials the year before in 76
yeah.
up in Eugene, Oregon. And in the semifinals, I think I ran 3:40 or... you know, somewhere around there, which is equivalent to a sub 4 minute mile. So
right.
I knew that I was capable, but it definitely shocked me that it came at my first indoor meet when I hadn't even been doing anything on the track. So I knew that I could do it because technically I'd done it in the trials the year before, but to actually do it in the first race and seem as easy as it was, you know, that was a good sign. And I was, you know, very, very pleased with it. Especially, you know, after the race, they announced the time, and I go, really? Wow.
And so by the time you graduate from Irvine, you've run, I think, around, 11 or 12 sub-4-minute miles.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're doing some great stuff. When you talk about Len Miller, because Len Miller was with you for how long? You guys were a team for a long time.
Yeah, through the 84 Olympics into 85.
Yeah. And how important is that to have somebody who knows you probably better than you know yourself?
You know, people think, oh, just the elite athletes, you know, need a coach. But really, everybody needs a coach. And, you know, especially as an Olympic athlete, because you are always second-guessing yourself. Because later on in my career, I did coach myself. And you're second-guessing, you know, how much you should do. You're always going to, you know, if you're a driven athlete, you're going to give yourself more than you should. And a coach is there to give you the right amount, pat you off when you need to, give you a kick in the butt when you need one. So, yeah, it was, in my instance, my career flourished when I was working with Len. But as soon as we stopped working together, it started going in the tank.
Yeah, that's so difficult. So July 79... Sebco in Oslo, and Oslo seems to be a common theme. Won the mile, went 3:48.95, and you go 3:51.1. running that fast, did you have a sense that you were ready to go that fast? That must have surprised you a little bit.
Well, I mean, I ran 3:53 in Invitational at Irvine my senior year in 1978. So
you knew it was there.
Yeah, I knew it was there. It's just a matter of getting into the right race with the right pace and the right competition. I mean, I ran the 3:53 pretty much all by myself.
Gotcha.
And I knew it was in there. And, I was disappointed that I didn't win the race.
Of course. I mean, look at the era when you ran in, where you're talking about Sebastian Coe and John Walker and Rod Dixon and Eamon Coghlan and just all the great guys that you raced against. Who were some of your best battles with?
I think I counted in one year, there was, 15 people, 12 people who had run under 3:50 for a mile, all in the same season.
Oh, my God.
So that, the 80s was the heyday of the mile.
It really was.
I don't think there's ever been a generation since that had that many quality runners running that well. So, I think the person that I really enjoyed competing against and had the most respect for was John Walker, because he was a world record holder. He was an Olympic champion. By the time that he and I started racing, he was a little bit, toward the tail end of his career, but he was one of those guys that was always competitive, always tough. He, in fact, in my American record mile race, he passed me with a lap to go and started pushing the pace. So, he was a tough competitor. Steve Ovett was also, Sebastian Coe, he did some great things, but he hardly ever raced.
It's true, yeah.
I mean, he would race maybe 5 or 6 times a whole season, where I would race 40 times
a year. I was going to say, I was looking, there were some years, I think you raced close to 50.
Yes, there were.
That's unbelievable.
Yeah, I had a few of those years. And so, Coe, you never saw him. Where Ovette, he would be out there racing. Steve Cram would be out racing. So, I had more respect for those guys that, maybe they're not at their best, but they still go out and throw it down with you.
Well, what I loved about that, especially during the indoor track era, when you had yourself and Coghlan and all those guys traveling from city to city, that did so much to create personalities for the sport and just a showcase for the mile. That was the highlight of the evening, the indoor mile.
People, they love fast times and great performances, but what really spurs them on is rivalries.
Totally.
I mean, that's what they love to see. They love to see two people going at it head-to-head. You remember back when Mary Slaney and Ruth
Wysocki, yep,
had the altercation, and when they were going to race indoors, they hadn't had a sellout indoors in years, and that year it sold out.
Exactly, because people don't, they might not understand two women who run, but they do understand two women who don't like each other, right?
Yeah.
Or two guys who don't like each other. Then all of a sudden the sport, and we've seen it in triathlon as well, in cycling, all of a sudden the sport that the sports writers didn't understand, they understood two guys, Eamon Coghlan saying, hey, I'm going to kick Steve Scott's ass. They understood that. They understood, oh, we better come watch that because there's some bad blood here.
I know that I don't think it's ever been quite the same since it was with the Mark Allen and Scott Tinley and Dave Scott days.
Exactly. No, you need that. You need the rivalries. And Chris McCormick did a great job, a few years ago with some of the German guys. But you need, if it's just one guy off the front, you don't have a sport. You got to have rivalries. You got to have that type of stuff. So when 1980, obviously, bittersweet year. You win the 1500 in the trials, but then no games. How hard was that it's not like you can go to somebody else who made an Olympic team and the Olympics didn't happen for the U.S. How did you deal with that?
It was a really hard thing to deal with, and especially because the American press was pro-boycott.
Weren't they, back then?
And so it was really, it made it more difficult because, guys like Dwight Stones and Francis LaRue, anybody that spoke out against the boycott, was labeled a communist.
Anti-American.
Yeah, anti-American, which is ridiculous. And so, I mean, can you imagine that today?
No, no. People would be, it's like, wait a second, you're going to ruin this guy's career because you're going into a foreign country? What does that have to do with sport?
Yeah, so it was tough, one, to miss it, but then tough even more so because the press was swaying public opinion.
Right.
And so you just felt like you couldn't say a word. I mean, these guys, you know, they were blasting the boycott, and I just kind of kept quiet because, I didn't want the press, down my throat. So you had no recourse. And then, they have this stupid thing at the White House where you get to meet Jimmy Carter, big deal.
Right.
They have a substitute Olympic thing in Philadelphia, and they were just trying to
placate you guys. We're doing something for you.
Yeah, we're doing something for you, so we won't badmouth them. Basically,
that's awful.
It was just, you really felt like you missed an opportunity a lifetime, and I had other opportunities, but someone like Don Page, who was Villanova graduate. He had won the NCAAs in the 8 and 1500, which is one of the toughest doubles there is. He could have won the gold medal. He could have beaten both Ovette and Co.
Yeah.
And he was hurt in 84, and his career was over. So that was his one opportunity at glory, and he was denied.
It's tough enough to be ready once every 4 years. It's tough enough to be on, because you get a Lassie Vierin who wins a 10 and a 5, two Olympics in a row, but that's so rare for people to be on two Olympics in a row. So for someone like you, not have the opportunity, because the Olympics is different than anything else. Going to Moscow, away from the U.S., getting a sense of the Olympic Village and how you deal with all that, and then having 84 when Olympics are at home, having that experience of an Olympics under your belt, I think would have made a huge difference for you going into 84.
Absolutely. And, I've been to World Championships and World Cups, but those are nothing compared to the Olympics. And that's, I think, what people don't understand is the Olympics get world attention for 2 years leading up to it. Right. And during those 2 years, you're doing interviews with radio, with TV, newspaper, there's magazines, and they're always asking you, what are your chances to win the gold medal? There's so much more attention brought to an upcoming Olympics than anything else. And so to not have the opportunity to actually run an Olympics and see that, it's just another race. Don't build it up into more than what it is. Just go out and run and do the best you can. But when you haven't ever been there before, you build it up in your brain to be something that's above and beyond anything that you've ever done before. And to a degree it is, but to live through it and be spit out the other side, definitely gives you the confidence to go in the next Olympics and know what to expect.
Yeah. The hard part is so many athletes in our sports are defined by how they do the Olympics. In triathlon, it's really how you do it. The Ironman, that's sort of the annual Olympics. But when it comes to when it comes to Steve Scott, 1500 meter guy, they go, 80, didn't get to go, 84 took 10th, and 88 took 5th. And that's tough, because look at your career, but so many people will define an athlete in swimming or in running or even in, in cycling by how they do in the Olympics. How tough was that for you to deal with, knowing that you were track and field magazine. You were the top guy for the U.S. for 10 years and 11 times in the top 10 for track and field for 1500. How hard was it to deal with, not having that great Olympics?
In track and field, you either have the gold medal or the Olympic gold medal or a world record.
Right.
Those are the two things they measure you by. And so to not have either really was frustrating.
Yeah, yeah.
I missed the world record by 0.3 of a second, missed the gold medal by 1 second, but that's how they view you, is what you did in terms of world records or Olympic gold medals. And they really don't look at anything else. So, I mean, that is a frustrating part because there are some great basketball, football, baseball players who had great careers but never won a World Series or NBA championship or Super Bowl.
Right. Yeah. And they, but they've got like a Tony Gwynn with great personal records, but not the World Series championships.
Exactly.
Yeah. So what is it about Oslo? You go to Oslo and you look at some of your fastest races there, 349, 348, 347, 69. What is it about that meet and that track that's so special?
I think it's the time of year. It's always in early July.
Uh-huh.
It's the track itself is really nice because it's like on the backstretch, you've only got six lanes. And so you know, on the home stretch, the track comes right up to the outside of the track. And so the people are right on top of you.
Right.
I mean, there's not that separation. Like you run in Oslo and there's, you know, 30 yards separation between the track and the stands. So it's the people are right on top of you. They are very loud. You know, they're hitting like there are these metal signs along the inside of the track.
Yeah.
They're pounding on them as you're running around. So I think it's just the closeness of the people. But another thing is the just the time of year. You know, I would train very hard all the way through until our national championships, which are always the end of June. And then when you fly over to Europe, you are forced to stop training because you're racing every 3 or 4 days. So you fly over, usually have 10 to 2 weeks. You're there before Oslo, and you're racing and jogging.
So you're tapered.
Yeah, you're tapering.
Gotcha.
So I'm rested. We run it at late at night. Usually it's like 10, 11 o'clock at night. So there's no wind. It's usually cool in Norway at that time of year. The quality of the track, always the quality of competition. And so it just came a mindset of like, okay, let's go run in Oslo and let's all run as hard as we can. And we don't care what place we come in. Let's just run a fast time.
Perfect. So when when you run that 347.69, and did you have did it surprise you that it lasted, that it is an American record for so long?
Yeah, because I thought I'd break it later on that year.
Exactly, right? You're going to go 346. What the hell?
Yeah, I thought, okay, I'm going to get that record. It's just a matter of time. I'll do it. But I didn't break it. I thought that, you know, there was so many people that came along that could break it. And,
yeah.
You know, you get kind of possessive of it. And
sure.
You say, well, I hope nobody breaks it. I hope nobody breaks it. Hope, you know, so-and-so doesn't break it. But then after 20 years, you're like, okay, I've had it long enough, and we need somebody to come along
it. It's sort of showing the country needs to step up. Somebody needs to step up and get this record.
Because a mile is one of those marquee events, and we didn't have anybody that was competitive on a worldwide stage.
No.
So,
until Alan Webb broke it, yeah.
Yeah.
So you were one of those guys, as a miler, I tell people this. I said, you know, besides racing 40, 50 times a year, Steve also ran 100 miles a week. And I'm like, why would a miler be running 100 miles a week? But you were different than the other milers weren't running that much, were they?
I would average around 90, to be honest.
Really?
I
mean, all of them? Okay.
I would rarely go up to 100, but my goal was always 90. So I was between 86 and 92. And that's, you know, during your build-up phase. You're not doing that year-round, but whenever I was in a building phase, that was my weekly mileage goal. But, you know, I did do more than most of my competitors in terms of volume of mileage. And, you know, it worked for me. I didn't have the incredible leg speed that Akram, Ovette, or Coe had. So you either get there through speed or strength. And I didn't have the same speed that they had, so I was concentrating more on being stronger. So if we were to race in a 3K, you know, we're at a mile, Coe, Ovette, Akram, myself, you know, we're all pretty close. They have the edge when it comes to speed. But if we were running a 3K, I'd kick all their butts.
The longer it went, you had a little more strength.
Yep.
You also stayed, I think, with all that running, you stayed pretty injury-free.
Yes, yeah. I don't think the first... God, I had like one little hamstring strain that kept me out of one of the early AAU meets, but other than that, the first time I came into any trouble was in my, you know, mid to late 30s when I started having some overtraining issues, and that wasn't an injury. That was just
age.
Training too hard.
Yeah, right.
That's what led to my triathlon career.
Exactly. Exactly. Which led to you getting people climbing over you in the water, which is always nice. One of my favorite Steve Scott videos is you, and I don't know if it was Puerto Rico, I don't know where it was, you were a rabbit for a mile, and I think it was a mile, indoors. Was it indoors? It could have been indoors or outdoors. But you were a rabbit, you had the fro going, and you weren't pulling off the track. And it was like, wait a second, the rabbit's not leaving. And you ended up, do you remember that one? Which race was that?
Oh, my gosh. I think that was indoors.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was one of the, it was indoors, and it was, well, I think that they thought that I was a rabbit, but actually, was it at the Jack in the Box down in San Diego?
Oh,
they didn't catch me until, like, the last lap.
No, you won. This is a race you were, like, they said, oh, Steve Scott's he's the rabbit here today, young man, and you had the fro going, and it was like, Mr. Scott's not pulling off the track. Like, you ended up winning the race. It was one of my favorite things. I love that. When they come to you and say, hey, you want a rabbit, do you think to yourself, yeah, I'll rabbit, but if I feel good, I'm going to go for it.
Everybody does that.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
I haven't met a rabbit yet that didn't think in their heart of hearts, well, I'm going to just hang in there and I'm going to get towed along.
Yeah.
But when the pack starts going by you, it's over.
It's time for breakfast. Yeah, yep. At that point. I love that. When you look back, Steve, what's the best race you ever had where you just felt it was effortless and you could have run all day?
You know, there was a race in, I think it was Ingelheim, no, not Ingelheim, I think it was in Koblenz.
Uh-huh.
And it was 1,500 meters, and Ovette had just broken the mile record. We were in separate races, which is pretty stupid.
Yeah.
So he runs a mile, he breaks the record, then right afterwards is the 1,500 meters, and I'm just running, and... You know, I take off in the last lap, and I finish the race, and you know, I run 3:31 something, and I go, "Oh my gosh, I could have broke the record tonight," because I never felt bad.
You felt good the whole time.
Yeah, the whole time, and it would have been awesome if he broke the mile record. He broke Crow's mile record, and it would have been hilarious if I broke his 1,500 meter record. But
that would have been a bad night for him.
Yeah.
So what's interesting is how you sort of reinvented yourself. Here you are, the track guy, and then this new event that Tim Murphy came up with, and you and John Walker helped create the Carlsbad 5000, a 5K course. And like you mentioned earlier, what's great about Oslo is it's the competition, right? Everybody goes there knowing they're going fast. When I look at Carlsbad 5000 course, it doesn't look fast. Two 180-degree turns, a couple little climbs, but it's the competition that makes it fast. When Tim first came to you and said, hey, I want to do a 5K on the roads, what were your thoughts?
Well, our thoughts were, because his course highlighted the interior of Carlsbad.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you go in the interior, some of those neighborhoods are not the best neighborhoods.
No.
And so what we thought was, well, you know, if it's not going to be a fast course, at least make it be visibly, you know, have beautiful
ocean
view
on your
right side going down, left side going back up.
Yeah.
So we were thinking of just the scenic beauty of running along the ocean. And then our second thought was spectator friendly.
Right.
So you have that middle part where you see everybody go by three times. And... the other thing was having separate races. Everybody at that day and age, everybody started the race together.
Right, yeah.
You know, there wasn't any elite race first and then the people or vice versa. So, you know, two things. One, that it was spectator friendly. And two, they separated. They had the people's races and then the elite race afterwards. and or one people's race and then the elite race. And so now you had thousands of people who had just competed watching the elite runners run instead of the elite runners going off first and
nobody seeing them.
Yeah. They don't get to see them.
Right. I love that. And it just took off from there. And so the first 3 years, you won the thing. And set 1332, 1330. And at that point, there weren't that many 5K, in terms of the road records, there weren't that many 5Ks on the roads that people were running, right, in terms of setting records.
No. And just a side note, you know, since I designed the course and I'm a miler,
yes,
I had the finish go downhill and not uphill.
Good move.
Yeah.
And that's usually coming around that last turn is when Steve Scott put the hammer down.
Yeah, you come around the last turn, you got a nice 200-meter downhill.
Boom.
I got the miler speed. It, you know, whatever, no matter how hard they push the pace early, I've got the downhill finish.
And I think you were the first runner to actually wear sunglasses in a race.
Yes. Yeah, that was that one too.
Carlsbad 5000. Remember we did that Scott deal and those guys, those things covered your entire face.
Oh, yeah.
Those things were ugly.
It was a Star Wars mask.
They looked like a Star Wars mask. So there was a point there, and I think it was 96 or so, when you were diagnosed with testicular cancer. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I mean, none of us knew much about that. We knew a diagnosis of cancer meant, oh, my God, this guy's going to die. How soon did they catch it? And, I mean, you must have been pretty scared.
Yeah, it was 94.
94,
and
I'm sorry.
I just run a sub 4 minute mile, which happened to be my last one at the Sunkist Invitational, or it was the LA Invitational, but it kind of replaced Sunkist.
Right.
And I accidentally found it. I was going in for a vasectomy, and the doctor urologist said, he said, "Well, you should get this checked out by a urologist." Went to the urologist. Had the sonogram, and they diagnosed it with as a testicular cancer, and, you know, funny enough, it's the exact same cancer that Lance Armstrong had.
Yeah.
The difference was that mine was caught extremely early, and, you know, I had the testicle removed. I decided to do the surgery to remove all the lymph nodes, and if they found any clusters of cancer cells, then I was going to have to go with the chemo and the radiation, but luckily they didn't find any, and so my experience was pretty minor compared to what Lance had to go through.
Well, it was interesting because back then we're doing a radio show, and that's what I was thinking, 96, is I remember when you were going through that and had Lance on the radio show, and he had said, "Hey, you know, Bob, can you please give me," we had done an interview, and right after that was Lance. And Lance said, "Hey, Bob, Steve's one of my heroes, and could you please give him my best?" And then he called me 2 years later, it must have been, wanting your phone number. And you remember that conversation?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Unfortunately, there's not much I could do to help him because his was so advanced that, you know, I couldn't share any experiences with him.
Yeah. But so you could tell over the phone that he was in, this was not good.
Right, right. And that's, you know, all the doctors were saying, they go, you know, as long as you catch it early, it's very treatable.
Right.
You know, an 85-90% cure rate. So, you know, catch it early and everything's fine. So, you know, when I knew that he wasn't a candidate for surgery, then I knew it was pretty bad.
Did the cancer affect you in terms of the rest of your, by 94, your career's pretty much wrapping up. So did you feel it affected your career?
Yeah, I mean, I was 38.
Yeah.
And by then, your international career is over. But remember, I had desires to break 40 as a master's runner.
Yes, first 40-year-old, yeah.
So it definitely disrupted that.
Gotcha.
I mean, I had to take a lot of time off. Was anemic afterwards, without training for such a long period of time. And really where it hurt me is getting away from speed work. Because when you get older, the first thing you lose is speed.
No question.
You know, the strength stays with you, but the speed. And to break a 4 minute for a mile, you got to have 50-second quarter speed at least.
Yeah.
And so that's really what I lost. And then when I would try to get that speed back, I kept pulling muscles. And so, you know, when you if you don't use it, you lose it. And getting away from the speed work, my muscles kind of, got weak.
Exactly. So your transition to coaching as being the head coach at Cal State San Marcos, and your women's team, I think, has run 3 national titles.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed pretty seamless. And a lot of times, great runners or great baseball players, great football players, don't make great coaches.
Right.
Sometimes it's, hey, well, I don't know, I went out there and I ran 136 sub 4 minute miles. Get out there. Was it tough for you to make that transition to coaching?
Well, it took them 9 years to win a championship, so maybe it took me a while to learn how to coach.
Or took you 9 years to figure out how to recruit.
Yeah.
You get the right gals.
It was a pretty seamless transition for me, because I really enjoyed what I was doing.
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoyed the coaching. I enjoyed the athletes that I was working with. I think the one thing that I had to come to grips with was the athletes didn't have the same work ethic or commitment that I had training for the Olympics.
Right.
I mean, and so I just had to remember that to keep things in perspective. You know, that's the most important thing, is just, you know, find out what each athlete's goals and desires are and help to coach them to maximize their goals, not my goals for them. And I think once I learned that, then it was pretty easy. And, you know, it's instead of thinking about yourself, and which is what an athlete is, I mean, athlete's very selfish, especially an Olympic athlete. And
sure.
Now it's just transitioning to helping them to be the best that they could be. And it was immediate gratification.
That's cool. And right, you were talking. We were talking earlier before we came on. You guys are. There's been a major change in terms of you guys are going to be your program is stepping up.
Yep, we just got accepted to NCAA Division II, and so we have one more year in the NAIA. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
And then we transition to D2. We'll have 2 years of probation, and all that means is we can't qualify for a national championship in any sport, but. You know, we'll have our same normal schedule. The team sports will all play. We'll be in the CCAA, which is the conference that UCSD is in, Chico State, Humboldt, all those
schools.
Oh, nice. So we'll be in their conference. We'll be playing a conference schedule. We'll be able to compete in the conference meet in both cross country and track. So I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be fun.
So you talk about goals for the athletes, and I remember 1 year. I think the goal the team set was, if we win another championship, coach has to get a tattoo. That was a good goal. And I think we chatted and you said, there's no way they can repeat and win. I mean, you took that bet because you were pretty confident they weren't going to do it, right?
Oh, yeah. I was very confident it wasn't going to happen. And then that's why I accepted the bet.
Of course.
And then, as the season went on, I realized that, okay, I'm going to have to get a tattoo because they have a very good chance of winning it.
Yeah. And what was that tattoo?
It was a heart that said national champions and 2010 national champions, and then their initials around the outside of the heart.
How excited were they about that? That must have been. They must have been laughing their butts off.
Oh yes, they were, and actually, many of them went in to watch me get the tattoo.
Oh, and Joanne, was she excited about that?
No, she knew I made the bet, but
yeah.
I had not told her that I was going to get the actual physical tattoo, because she was like, oh, they won't care if you don't do it. Just forget it. They'll forget about it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, I'm a man of my word, and if I made the agreement, I have to follow through. So I went and got the tattoo and didn't tell her about it. So I go home, and I go, Joanne, there's something that I have to tell you. And she looks at me and says, you're having an affair. And I go, no, not even close. So I go, oh, I got a tattoo. So I show it to her, and she was relieved that I wasn't having an affair, but she was not happy that I got the tattoo and went and just smacked it as hard as she could with her flat hand, which did not feel good.
Oh, that is funny. I love it.
And then she goes, okay, I feel better.
Are you still loving the coaching?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That's
I love it. In fact, I got one of my pride and joys sitting in my office with me right in front of me, Ray Lynn Worley.
Tell us a little about Ray Lynn.
She's a sophomore.
Okay.
And she is currently my number two runner and just has the best attitude. She's a team leader, great work ethic. I could just put a list of workouts on the wall and never go out, and I know she'd do every single one of them. Of course, that wouldn't be any fun for me, but you know, great student, great person. So, I mean, it's just great. That's why coaching is so much fun when you have people like Ray Lynn on your team.
Love that. Well, Steve, she sounds like a little bit like you. Guy with a great personality who does every workout and does everything it takes to be great. And I appreciate you taking so much time and chatting. It's really cool to see a guy who really was not the star when he was in high school go on to greatness. And I think it gives people a lot of hope that, hey, you don't have to start. It's not how you start. It's how you finish, right?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, if you work hard, that's why I go and talk to, you know, young people. I go, if you go out and are dedicated and work really hard, you could be a very, very, very good athlete. You know, you could be make it to CIF, you could make it to state. And so you're seeing the fruits of your labor. So, I mean, all it takes is just work. Work hard and you could be a very good athlete.
There's no shortcuts. You just do it.
Yeah, that's right.
Love
it. No
shortcuts. Hey. Steve, thanks so much for coming on Babbittville Radio. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks, Bob.
All right. This is Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We're brought to you by Calton 20, and you can go to cal1020.com. 10 miles, 20 bands. Coming up on February 15th, 2015, Core Sports, the very best in women's activewear. Challenge Athletes Foundation, our event's coming up on October 19th, San Diego Triathlon Challenge, a 21st annual. And, of course, you can check out any of our interviews at Babbittville Radio on iTunes. Hold on, everyone. We will be right back.